Access number 16632, Kitty Hart Moxon, reel 9, followed after a pause by reel 10. Left channel is informant's mic only, right channel informant plus interviewer.
Kitty Hart Moxon, reel 9.
Our next place of work was a cave in the mountains in a forested area called the Teutoburger Wald. We were brought to this cave and you actually couldn't see anything at all. It was a clearing again in the forest. It was about a 2-hour walk through the forest. I recall the walk to the forest was gathering acorns. Because we lived on acorns very much at that time, and leaves and stuff like that that was in the woods to supplement the bread ration, because food was even by that time almost non-existent. This factory, we think, we thought, belonged to Phillips at one time. It was a Phillips factory, but at that time, of course, geared to munition work, again, something we think to do with aircraft. Exactly what we were doing, we don't know. It was all highly secretive, and we were never told. The work itself was not particularly difficult. We were sitting at the tables, in fact, the sitting down work. The problem there was the actual atmosphere. Because it was in a cave, and it was, I believe, something like 11 shafts underground, of sort of special lifts to take us all the way down underground, the air wasn't very good. And the German personnel only worked very short hours, but we did 12-hour shifts, and we used to come up gasping for air by the end of the shift. So we seemed to be very short of oxygen there. Also, it was very cold because it was unheated and it was a cave. And it was actually lit up because we were sitting at tables and doing some work, but it wasn't heated. And then we still had about 2 hours walk back to the camp. But fortunately, my mother wasn't working anymore. She got out of work there. And also, when I got back, she always managed to get some soup for me. So there at that stage, she was a tremendous help to me, to just sustain me that little bit, and she didn't have to go to work. Now, we're talking about, I think it must have been beginning of March 1945, I can't actually put a date on it, and I can't put a date on when they began to evacuate us, but I don't think we were all that very long, possibly the middle of March. They began. One day, again, we'd been called out that we were going to be evacuated. Well, they were going to shunt us backwards this time because, of course, the Allies could have not been very far. We were not very far from the Netherlands. And we could hear some gunfire from very distance. So we did realize that the front was approaching. And we wondered when there was going to be what was going to happen next, because the order was that no prisoners were to be handed over alive. We knew, they were going to try and dispose of us some way. Anyway, we were called out. There was again a roll call, and we tried very hard, 100, to stick together. But somehow we got mixed up. There was a commotion. I can't remember what it was. And the next thing was they started counting people. They were counting so many people, and they divided the whole thing into two. One lot one way, one lot the other. We were led in one way, and the other group was led elsewhere. And we were loaded onto lorries, and I believe there was no room for the other half onto the lorries. And we learned after the war that the other half were taken into the forest, and they killed them off that day in the forest. And we lost most of our original Auschwitz girls at that point, because we were 100, and at point of liberation we were 12, you see. So out of this 100, although there were only privileged girls who survived Auschwitz 2 years, some of them, they had privileged positions, they'd been through terrible times, and they'd survived all this, and there was a luck of the draw. It was sort of divided up and they disappeared. Because we didn't know that, that the only was found after the war. Anyway, we were transported and they took us backwards to a place called Fallersleben. Again, that was a bombed out factory where pre-war there was a car plant. They were making, I believe there were cars called DKW before the war. And that factory was bombed out. And that's where they put us. I don't know what they thought they were going to do with us. I think there was no more work going on there. And we were housed, funny, it was very warm in that place still, although it was all bombed out. It was the first building that we'd been in. And they put us all in this one great big hall. Obviously, that was a plant where, you know, where they were manufacturing something. It was a huge, and there was a running water there, something we hadn't seen for years. And of course, the first thing we did, we took our clothes off and started washing clothes. First time we washed clothes, but since I left Canada, it's still the sort of the same clothes, you know, that we got on evacuation. It hadn't been off my back at all from January. So we tried to clean ourselves up, having this running water. Food was getting even scarcer by that time. And we raided the SS kitchens as well there, because there were lots of air raids. And during the air raids, all the SS would go down into the bunkers. They still had these air raid shelters and bunkers, but we refused to go. And this man in charge of this factory couldn't understand why did we not want to go into the bunkers. And he called us all down, I remember, and they had these airtight doors into air raid shelters. And he said, oh, all the prisoners have got to go because there's a great big air raid and nobody can stay out there. And one of our girls got up to him, and I'll never forget that, it was a great big fat man, and she got up to him and she got hold of his belt, and she sort of went backwards and forwards. She said, we are not going into there, you might as well shoot us now, we're not going into there, there's gas in there, you're going to gas us, we know this is a gas chamber. And this SS chap was completely taken aback. He looked as though he didn't know what we were talking about. And so he said, just tell me about this gas chamber. Just I am. And so we told him where we'd just come from Auschwitz, what there was, and what a gas chamber. It was just like this, airtight doors. We know this because we did a gas in here. This man had no idea. I mean, I felt that was one person that didn't know. He said, all right, you don't have to go, you can stay upstairs and get bombed. And so every time there was an air raid, they would all go down. And while they were down, we used to raid the SS kitchens. And I remember one day, the personnel there in the kitchen had got ready a huge bowl of grated potato. They were going to make potato cakes or something, and we just got these raw potatoes and we just dished them out and we were eating these raw potatoes. And when they came back, they were absolutely furious. They wanted to know who raided the kitchens, you know, and they were going to punish us, but they didn't. They actually at that point they didn't. I think they already knew the beginning of the end. They didn't touch us. And if we wanted to, we could have actually escaped at that point. But of course, we realised, you know, that was a useless exercise in the midst of Germany somewhere. We were picked up, we had no hair, and bedraggled, we would have been picked up and shot on the spot. So we didn't attempt it. Anyway, this factory was bombed as well, and so they decided they were going to move us out, and they would put us back into lorries, and this time they shipped us to Belsen. Well, when we got into Belsen, they didn't put us into a main camp. They simply put us into a totally bare piece of enclosure. There was nothing there. There were no tents, because I believe they had tents and tented camp and whatever. Well, they didn't. We were just left in a sort of a bare enclosure. There was nothing there. And no food, nothing. Whatever it is, nowhere to lie down, nothing. And I think we were there about 3 days. And they just suddenly came and said, out. And they moved us out. us back into the train. And this time, they moved us to a side. They took us on these lorries to a siding, and the siding had several goods trains. I don't know how many, but you could actually hear from some of them. You could hear people inside. And before we knew what was happening, they pile us into the trucks, into the cattle trucks, and they just sort of, there was a kind of a bolt, you know, the door shut, bolted, and that's it. And we found ourselves in total darkness in this truck. Now, this particular truck smelled of cheese. I remember that moment. I said, yeah, this smells of cheese. It's cheese stuff. It's airtight. And it was actually airtight. It wasn't a cattle truck. It was some freight truck. Well, fortunately, I always carried a knife because of the, I thought, you know, you must have a spoon, you must have a bowl, you must have a knife. You're not allowed to have a knife. But I knew a knife is something you never know when you might need it. And this truck, as I said, was total darkness. And I don't know how many of us were, but we were packed in there. And gradually, of course, it became stifling in there, and the walls were all damp with condensation. And we realised we're going to suffocate there. So, if you could get down onto the floor, you could see cracks to the ground, and that was the only air, I think, that was coming in, because the truck wasn't so like a wooden truck. It looked, you know, it was like panelling, but you could see. You could see daylight underneath. So we realised air was coming in from the bottom. And so with this knife, I managed to enlarge a crack or two, and we sort of tried to breathe, you know, just kneeling on the ground and taking turns to breathe. And this quite a lot of us managed to do this. If you could get down, of course, you were in total darkness. Now we have no idea how long we were in this truck, because it was, we didn't know it was day or whether it was night. It was total darkness. And gradually I realised a lot of people were losing consciousness, and they were actually suffocating in the truck. You could hear screams from adjoining trucks, but gradually this stopped and it became very quiet. And of course our truck also became very quiet. We were just pleased we could breathe, but we suddenly realised that we were left abandoned there, at that point. I don't know how long we were there, but at one stage we heard some footsteps. And as we heard the footsteps, many of us started banging against this side of the truck. Help, help, open up, we're suffocating, you know, this sort of thing. And lo and behold, opened the one truck. They opened this, suddenly the door opened. And as the door opened, we were sort of lined up against the wall of this truck, or the door of this truck, or whatever. We just fell out, because there was, everyone was pushing onto the side of this truck. And as we fell out, we fell onto three SS men. And of course, they were taken aback. They had no idea. Perhaps I don't know what they were doing there, whether they were supposed to be there, whether they were probably not supposed to have opened this truck at all. But we were the only truck that was open. And there were one or two trains there. It wasn't just our truck. There were trains at the siding. We didn't know where the siding was at that time. Well, when we dropped out of this truck, you know, just gasping for air, my mother got up and said, "Look, kill us off now. We're not going back into this truck." Oh, yeah, and they sort of startled these men. And my mother said, "We demand to be taken into a camp, into a concentration camp." And so these men conferred, you know, we realised they were talking, what are they going to do with us, you know, were they going to shoot us or what? But there were officers, three officers. And so one of them went off. And shortly afterwards he came back and said, there's a camp nearby, and the commandant said he'll take you in. So they marched us off from that siding. Now, don't ask me how far and how many of us. Some of these people were no longer alive under that truck. They were already weakened anyway, and couldn't get to any cracks and bleed. There weren't a few of us that were still alive. They took us into this camp called Salzwedel. That was actually a staff camp, which I didn't know either at the time, on the base camp called Neugamme. There was a large camp called Neugamme, and they had base camp. There was a camp called Dora, I believe, and Salzwedel was one of the sub camps. So they took us in there. This particular siding, I believe, was outside somewhere not far from that town. Now, what I didn't know for years and years and years, because this was Eastern, the former DDR, and there was no contact, but I had recently had contact with this town, that they found these trains with prisoners sealed inside after liberation, the German, the population, and they opened these trucks and they buried about 300 or 400, 700 they buried, and that was the train, and that was the siding where they opened the one truck. Well, when we got to this camp, same camp as any other, the women's camp, they all were working, some were working in a chemical plant just outside the town. The camp was on the outskirts of the town, and some were working in a sugar refinery. And we very quickly realised that these girls were in pretty good condition. And we realised that somehow or other they obviously had access to food, and not just food that had been brought into the camp. They must have had other type of food. And we did actually locate some of the food. They worked in the sugar refinery, they lived on sugar. Or which perhaps lived on sugar beet, I don't know, but they certainly hoarded sugar, which we eventually found and had to help ourselves because we didn't have any more food. When we came into this camp, from then on, there was no more food in there at all. They were just threw in a few beets and a few cabbages, but they were no longer handing out any bread. And I'm speaking about probably the beginning of April, and I was sort of liberated on the 14th, so it was actually 2 weeks without any food whatsoever that was given out, unless you could, there was nothing to find in the camp other than what these other prisoners had, and they were no longer working. You see, all the areas there were, there was already the front line, I believe, you could already hear gunfire. And bombs going off and grenades going off. But we were there 2 weeks in that camp. What I recall from that time was we were just sitting watching the SS guard stores most of the time, because their food stores were visible from the camp. Their bread stores, in fact, were visible. You could see all these loaves stacked up on the other side of the electrified fence, but it wasn't for us, it was just the SS stores, and they were no longer feeding the prisoners. Now, what we didn't know, that there was a French prisoner of war camp nearby, and these prisoners had already been liberated, and they warned the commandant that if they did something, you know, to the prisoners, they will be responsible for what happens to the prisoners. And the leaflets started appearing in the camp. The French prisoners of war that had already been liberated sent messages to say they were going to cut the electrified fence at the appropriate time, and that the camp is actually mined. And the plan was to blow it up at the last moment. And we shouldn't be afraid, because they were going to see that nothing happens to us. Well, we didn't know where the front was at that time. By that time we were really on a starvation diet. There really was no food at all, and no means of getting any food. I say, there were piles of beet, and even then you were not allowed to touch it. They were not issuing it, you see. Wouldn't allow people to go near. And I remember the last few days, I was just simply sitting around looking at these loaves. And about 2 or 3 days prior to liberation, we found the SS had sort of disappeared. But now and again, one of them would venture into the camp. And one day, one came in, and we realised that he wasn't actually armed. And so we threw ourselves onto this particular man, and we stripped him, ripped his uniform to shreds, and he tried to defend himself. And I saw he had a knife, one with a bayonet stand. They sort of carried it in their pockets. And I grabbed this off him, so I just had a knife. And I wasn't going to, obviously not going to kill him, but I had this knife at that point. And he broke loose eventually, and of course all the women SS then disappeared. They, by the way, many of them are volunteered women from the town itself that worked as overseers in the camp, which, because I didn't know at the time. At the point of liberation, I didn't know anything about liberation, and they were talking about the town was going to capitulate, and they're going to hang out white flags, and they're not going to, they're not going to blow up the camp, they're not going to fight, and that the power, the French prisoners of war going to switch this power off. But I remember just recall being sitting there watching the loaves, and I thought, well, if this happens, that's where I've got to go. I've got to get into these SS stores, get to the loaves. And then girls were just sitting around, and bullets were flying, all over, because there was fighting all around, although the town itself capitulated at the end. And bullets were flying, and people got hit, and so you had to dodge these bullets. But I was sitting just watching these SS stores, and I remember some of the things shaking and saying, look, there's some very strange tanks going past, and we don't think those are, they don't look like German tanks. We didn't know what they were, they were just passing by. They didn't even bother to come into the camp. And then suddenly one tank turned and just smashed through the gates on the camp. Well, of course, they were the Americans. Although we had no idea they were the Americans, we didn't know the Americans were fighting in the war. At that stage, we had no idea. We thought they were the Russians, but they happened to be the Americans. And it was the 52nd Division, A Squadron of General Peyton's army. Anyway, my first reaction was I smashed the glass into the SS stores and climbed in through the window, and I came out with an armful of loaves, which we hadn't seen for weeks and weeks. And as I did that, of course, there was a stampede, and everything was torn out of my hand, and I just came with one loaf to my mother. So that was the point of liberation. The next thing is, the gates were thrown open, and we threw ourselves onto these tanks, and these bewildered soldiers who didn't know what had hit them. And of course, the first thing they announced is that they had no food for us. That, they said, we're free, but we can't feed you. There is a town, go and get it. And at that point, of course, there was a rampage and stampede into the town of Dalsby. And that rampage lasted 3 days. And we were not the only ones, of course. There were a lot of labour camps and POW camps, and we all got mixed up and rushed into the town and into the houses and tried to find food, and which there wasn't very much. You couldn't find an awful lot. Most of it was stashed away, hidden away. I remember going into a place, and it was on Molkerai. There's no word for it. It was a cellar where there were pasteurizing milk or something like this. And there were full of milk churns there, that I remember. We all returned a whole lot. Just drank the milk with our hands and, just splashed around with it. And we got into houses looking for, mostly looking for bread and other food stuff and flour. Because we couldn't find anything, But in one place we dislodged a bath, I remember, and we piled it up with whatever we could find, you know, tins of preserves and sugar and stuff like that, and try to bring it back. You know, there was no way of bringing it all back in, back to the camp. But my mother was at that stage very busy because she was already talking to reporters. And in fact, hers was probably one of the very first accounts of Auschwitz, because nobody had heard of Auschwitz at that stage. It had been liberated by the Russians. Well, of course, they heard about it, but no eyewitness accounts. So she, my mother was already, hers was probably one of the first accounts that went out. And Belsen wasn't liberated until, I think, a day or two after, and that was liberated by the British. But of course, I was liberated by the Americans. Anyway, we went on this three-day rampage. On one occasion, I got into a cellar, I believe. And in that cellar was, well, there were a lot of people there hiding in that cellar. And quite a lot of older people and women and children. There was a stampede into this cellar, you know, and people kept on saying, "You've got a knife, you must kill them." Because I had this knife, you see, of this SS officer. And I couldn't do it, naturally. I couldn't do it. In the end, I threw this knife, and it sort of embedded itself somewhere in a different part of the cellar. It's quite dark in there. And people came up to me, and they started shaking me by the hand and thanking me. But I just threw myself to the ground because I really wanted to kill them, but I couldn't. You know, and I had all these people at the back of me egging me on. Anyway, we just ran out of there. In some places, we simply set fire to the interior and destroyed everything that we could lay our hands on. We didn't really want to loot anything. We didn't have any clothes. In fact, when I got back to the camp, my mother said, "Well, if you're going there, find some shoes or find something to wear, because we've got to get rid of these clothes." And so on the third day, I decided to look for clothes and things, which there was nothing anymore. Everything had been looted by that time. Well, then came a decree by the Americans. You know, you must not go into their houses, you must not loot, and they started to bring foods in and organizing the camps and taking us away from this camp, and they put us into some former barracks, which they named Camp Wasser, after American school, I believe, isn't it? Yes. And that's where they were fingerprinted and, you know, eventually sorted out and registered. But the next thing that happened was, because there was still fighting going around this along this area, and I sort of offered my services to do a little bit of interpreting. My English was very, very poor at that stage, but I could just understand enough, and of course my mother as well. And I was taken and asked, would I come and do some interpreting? And could I speak a little bit of Russian? I said, well, I can a little bit, not too much, because I learned a little bit of Russian at one stage, you know, when we tried to get to Russia. And I was taken into a large room where there was a conference with a large map on the table. And believe it or not, they were carving up the territory between the Americans and the Russians and the British at this conference. And I was asked to interpret, and they were drawing lines, which part was yours and which was going to be American, which was going to be Russian. And they made a decision to hand this town over to the Russians, although it was liberated by the Americans. And this became the frontier town of the DDR in West Germany, that particular town. But it wasn't, the Russians were going to take it over. The Russians general wanted that particular town, and the Americans retreated. And of course, I came back to the camp and I said, "The Russians are taking over this town." Because total chaos everywhere, there was no transportation, and so we begged the Americans to take us with their tanks and move us out before the Russians take over. Because not everybody managed to do that, a lot of the girls were left behind. We were 12 Auschwitz girls at that stage, and we all came out with the Americans. And they eventually dumped us on the British side, because they were moving south and they were still fighting. You see, they were actually a fighting force, and they hadn't by no means finished fighting, because you know they were still fighting further down south, and part of that area wasn't liberated until the 5th of May. And this was the 14th of April. So we were taken on one of the last tanks, and they dumped us in Brunswick. They said, we're going to leave you here, we can't take you any further. We don't know which is going to be the American sector at this stage, which, because they didn't know. And that's how I came to Brunswick and eventually came to work for the Quakers.